All right, Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rapport. This week we have on Gabriela Camara, chef of the iconic Mexico City restaurant Contra Mar. She also runs Cala in San Francisco. And Gabby just released a cookbook a few weeks ago called My Mexico City Kitchen, Recipes and Convictions. It's full of the type of dishes she serves at her restaurants. Super fresh, local, and seafood forward. We chat about how she makes her guacamole, because I had to ask that question. The trajectory of her career. She opened Contra Mar when she was just 21 years old. And her newest project, the forthcoming restaurant she's opening with Squirrels, Jessica Kozlow, in Santa Monica. Okay, here we go. Gabriela Camara, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Adam.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I still have not had breakfast.
What?
I've only had two cappuccinos.
Oh, two cappuccinos. Whole
one
milk?
One at 8 a.m. and the other one just 20 minutes ago.
Are you like a hotel type? Do you stay with friends when you come to New York? Airbnb? What's your sitch?
No, I'm a hotel type. In New York, I like to stay at a hotel. I usually stay... Yeah, I came for this dinner that was at Kim Hastrider's house last night.
Okay,
and
sure.
And so I stayed at the Marlton.
Oh, nice.
For the first time.
Yeah.
It's a really cool place. Rooms are small.
Yeah, that's like...
But they're very cool. It's a very cool... I'd never been in.
That's most New York, or at least downtown-ish New York
hotels.
You're like, wow, cool place, but small rooms are very expensive.
Where do I put my toothbrush?
Yeah, exactly. You have like one little closet with two hangers. And you're like, oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Let's say you were in Mexico City, back at your own place. What's your morning routine in terms of food or coffee?
I always start with coffee. And I usually do have some kind of breakfast. Mm-hmm. But just today I had to get out sooner than I don't like to have, you know, like a hearty... I don't like to have eggs at 8 a.m. when I
wake
up.
Yeah.
No, I need to do something before and then I can have breakfast.
And we will talk about your book and your restaurants and everything, but I realize my alarm goes off basically at 6:45 to get my kid ready for school and everything. Then I go get a nice coffee. I realize I don't actually eat anything until I get to work and make something in the test kitchen. So at that point, it's probably 9:15, 9:30. I've almost been up for 3 hours at that point.
I am totally that way.
Yeah.
I never even have coffee before I drop Lucas off at school.
Yeah. So your book is coming out
April
30th. The book will already have been out when this podcast is airing.
My book is out.
Congratulations. It's beautiful. My Mexico City Kitchen with wonderful photos by our friend Marcus Nilsson. I love the cover with just so many ripe, gorgeous limes and a little lime citrus squeezer on there. And that beautiful, like, sort of like, the Mexico and the color blue? Just there's something about it. Just
you think
maybe it's
so?
The ocean. I think a lot of times at restaurants and stuff.
I think of Contramar with the color blue, but not Mexico.
Well, no, you see a lot of blue plates and stuff in Mexico.
Well, you do have the blue Talavera, like the, and then you have the blue Frida Kahlo, of course, which is...
Yeah, I don't know. For some reason...
Very distinct.
For some reason, in my mind, it's very evocative.
Good.
I don't know. But yeah, so that beautiful blue.
I love blue. It's my favorite color.
So let's talk about the book. Love the book. Love the recipes. Love your restaurant, Contra Mar.
I didn't
know much about you. I mean, I knew you personally... socially somewhat. I didn't know much about your background. It's interesting reading the book, learning that your mother was Italian, father was Mexican. They met in the States while they were studying in college back in the 60s. So talk about that sort of interesting dichotomy of like growing up in Mexico, but with an Italian mother who obviously brought different sort of cooking sensibilities to your house. And what was it like being the kid with the Italian mom?
Well, I think I've always been in places where I don't really fit in, but I do. So I was born when my parents decided to get married, they moved to Chihuahua in the north of the country, where neither of them were from there. And they were working there. My father had this project in a community, so we were not from there. And then we moved to Mexico City, and then from there my parents decided that they wanted to raise my brother and myself in the countryside. So we had we really had the fortune of growing up in Tepoztlán, which was a really small town. It still is a small town, but now it's very full of fancy homes for weekends and a lot of tourists during the day because it's very close to Mexico City. So it's a good sort of like day trip for Mexico City, and it's packed. But we never fit in. I mean, we did, but we were always sort of the black sheep of wherever. But I think my parents have always been the black sheep of their family. So it's something that I've sort of inherited. And I have come to think that that's great now. But when I was growing up, it wasn't always easy. Like, I wanted my mom to know how to make tortillas like every other woman in the town. And my mother did not care about making tortillas. And I wanted my mom later to, like, be fancy and go play tennis and get a manicure. And she was an academic. She was not into that. And my father was always, like, I mean, they were these very cool, not hippies, but very, very liberal, very progressive. We've always been sort of, I mean, the word is horrible, but we've always been sort of weird.
Yeah.
You know, like not weird, but not your common,
but aren't,
like, not your conventional Mexican family anywhere. Like, not in the fancy way that, like, some of my family is, or not in the, I don't know. It's always sort of a, you know, in Italy, I was not Italian. In Mexico, I was not fully Mexican. In the States, I've always been, you know, from Mexico. It's always.
But isn't that the most interesting people? It always seems like the most interesting people are ones who have childhoods that are a little challenging or a little unorthodox.
No, and you think it's cool when you're older, but when you're young, I remember when my parents would take me out of school for 3 months, and of course we went to Italy and it was great, but then I'd come back and.
Your classmates were, where were you?
I mean, it wasn't traumatizing, fortunately, but it was, I do remember I tell my mom, but like, I got the best grades. I'm going to carry the flag. How am I going to, like, leave for 3 months? And they didn't. I mean, my parents always never thought that school was that important, fortunately. And they made it easy and everything. Like, we go to good environments. It wasn't like I was suffering. But it was, I guess, constant learning to adjust that now I very much appreciate. But when you're growing up, you just want to do what you want to do, what every other kid does around you.
Yeah, you don't want to be different.
You know.
So when, at what age did you start to feel like you found yourself and start to feel like you fit in and found your people?
I guess when I opened Contramar, which is why I just stayed in restaurants.
Yeah, which was really young.
Yeah.
So you went to college in
I went to university
Mexico
in
City.
Mexico, and in Mexico, it's not college. You go to one subject.
Yeah.
So I had a really difficult time deciding what to study.
And you have to decide that at 17.
Like, yeah.
What I'm going to be.
Physicist.
Yeah.
Like, you just do engineering and physics and math. And I decided I would study history because it was a more general, you know, it was a lot of philosophy, literature.
Gave you some options afterwards,
yes.
Potentially.
And I wanted
to
be,
if you want to open a restaurant.
No, yeah. No, I was not, that was not on my radar, unfortunately, or unfortunately, because then I did other things that were more interesting before. And I do think that people in restaurants that have done other, that have, like, either seriously been in other disciplines or have experiences beyond restaurant world in life are so much more interesting in terms of their...
It gives the restaurant some texture and some and some depth. And I remember we were interviewing Rita Sodi and Jody Williams from E. Sodi and Via Carota and everything. Mm-hmm. And Rita grew up in the fashion business in Italy and moved to New York and never worked in a restaurant kitchen and never run a restaurant. But she was like, I want to open a restaurant because there's no good Italian restaurants in New York.
Yeah.
And she opened a very unique place that when you go into her restaurant at E. Sodi, you feel like you're someplace that is not like any other restaurant.
Totally.
Because it's totally hers and her own weird, I don't want to say weird vision.
Yes,
but
yes, yes.
Vision.
But unique. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Totally unique and very distinct of her. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I thought I would be an academic because that's the environment I grew up in. And that's sort of what I just grew up thinking that I would be. And so my mother is an art historian, and I would always go with her to conferences or when I was studying. And I said, you know, it's very interesting, but if I'm going to be in art, I'm going to be in contemporary art because people in contemporary art dress so much cooler than anybody else. And I was always sort of interested in different things. And I was always interested in food, but never considered going to cooking school because I didn't want to be a chef.
But then
it wasn't cool like it is now to be a chef in the 90s.
It is. Back then, and I've talked about this before in the pod, like, it was like a job. There was a lot of manual labor involved. It was very sort of like,
it still is that. No, everybody thinks it's very cool and sophisticated, but it's actually a lot of just hard physical labor.
Yeah, but you know what? Any job that comes with, like, rewards and fame and all that stuff often is a result of a lot of hard work.
You know? For sure.
People always,
for sure,
people
but it
always
isn't
see
sitting
the upside.
On a desk.
Yeah, people always see the upside. They don't see all that went into it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you didn't want to open a restaurant, but then you went with your friends to the beach to party and hang out. And so all of a sudden you had this idea.
No,
yeah,
I always, yes.
You're saying you didn't go to the beach and party?
No, no, I did. Yes. And I went to the beach since I was, you know, all my life because my grandparents, I guess in Italy, everybody's used to going to the beach a lot. Like, everybody goes to the beach at least,
and
you know, during the summer.
Also,
during
you know what I love about Italy? You go to the beach and Mexico, and you eat well.
Yes.
In America, you go to the beach, you do not eat well.
Exactly.
You're bringing stuff to the beach, and the sand gets in
yes.
it. There's no restaurants there on the beach, or if they are, they're like boardwalk crap.
Yeah, yeah.
In Italy and Mexico,
you
can
eat
actually
well.
Eat well in great restaurants
so,
and sit down.
So, and then, you know, and my grandfather loved to fish, so we'd go fishing, and then we would cook. But I always had said that I wanted to, when I would retire, I wanted to open a bed and breakfast in Italy, and I wanted to retire. And I was
so
like,
you were like 20 years old, and you already think about retiring.
Well, I thought that eventually I would like to do that. Like,
yeah.
Eventually I would love to have a restaurant or something, but not, I had no idea about it. So anyways, when we were this New Year's party with this other friend who was living in Italy and didn't want to live in Italy, and you know, he was living in Turin, working at the Fiat company. He was not happy there, and we just said, let's just open a restaurant. Let's just have like ceviche and grilled fish, and we'll see. And it really was sort of an experiment of a very, very reduced menu.
Well, hold on. How old are you at this point?
I was 21.
21. Okay, so like when most Americans typically are graduating.
Yeah, it was my last
college,
year in college.
And you would go to the beaches.
Well, college was 5 years, so
okay.
It was my
university.
Yeah. University. Yes.
And in Mexico, you would typically go to Zihuatanejo.
Yes. But I've been going there all my life.
And you'd have ceviche and grilled fish
and fresh, you know, beans that were just mashed with the lard there, and fresh tortillas and sauces, and
you're like, why can't we do this in
and
Mexico?
And we also realized that in Mexico City, Mexico is such a centralized country that you actually have amazing fish in the city that you didn't enjoy, because also it was the 90s. People were into, you know, foie gras and sardines from Spain mussels from New Zealand. Nobody was into local fish.
And then the molecular gastronomy thing started happening.
That was much fancier.
But, you know, there's a long history of, like, restaurants from elsewhere. Like, people want to open, I'm just going to open a cool Portuguese-style beach restaurant in New York City, and it just doesn't translate. Or, you know, to try to transfer the vibes in emotion and culture of a particular restaurant in a particular environment, in this case, on the beach in Mexico, and move it into this massive city in the middle of the country, landlocked. Like,
that's not easy
to do.
I know, but I guess we did it because we didn't really think about it that much.
Yeah.
We just
so good.
Did
like,
it.
Sometimes, like, yeah, don't overthink it.
And we really did it because we had no idea about it. If we would have known more, we would have, you know, put more, I don't know, maybe it wouldn't have felt so fresh in a way.
It also felt
fresh because we did it with so little.
So how many partners to start?
Four.
Four.
Four. And if I tell you our original investment.
Do any of them still exist as partners?
No, they don't. Because one other one went on and he has like a big group of restaurants in Mexico City, super successful. The other one has like is more into coffee, and then another one just went out of restaurants. And he's my current partner bought this other partner out very early on.
How much did it cost to open the restaurant?
No, I'm not going to tell you.
Why
it's
not?
Ridiculous.
It's 20
no,
years
it's
ago.
Ridiculous.
Why is it ridiculous?
Because
it's 20 years ago. It's
because
water under
it
the bridge.
We went to the markets to buy our grill, and it was just, you know how in Mexico you have these street stands where you have basically like a gas little tank.
Yep.
And you open the
little nozzle.
Yeah,
and everything.
And you have these like the star with pipes with little holes in them.
Yep.
That's how our kitchen was made. I mean, our grill
how
for the fish.
How much did it cost to open the restaurant?
Less than $50,000.
That's great. So the whole thing, the whole kit and caboodle. So you open this restaurant.
But it looked nice. It always looked like simple but nice.
Mural over the bar.
And that was our biggest expense. I went into the space and I thought, no, we need color. And my uncle was a really good painter, and he had made these murals in another restaurant that was sort of relevant in my growing up in Mexico City. It was a restaurant by the university, so sort of more of an intellectual crown. Anyways, he had made these murals. It was an Italian restaurant, so he'd made these murals of Florence and of Venice. And, you know, of course, I felt really, anyways, I thought to me, when I thought we need color here, it was okay, let's ask my uncle immediately for something. And I think he really nailed it because we didn't have money. So he said, it can't be intricate. It can't be sophisticated. It can't be, like, we need to do something really simple. And he did something so simple that has become iconic, and we don't need anything else.
But it's this big blue mural. Yeah. It's at once, it looks both modern and very traditionally Mexican, sort of native, back centuries.
I really think it's the success of that place is that mural.
But also evokes the sea, yes?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Okay, so let's talk about the restaurant itself. So Contra Mar, what I love about the restaurant, and I have many thoughts, and I think it's at once...
it's so fun to hear you talk about it.
Okay, so I think it's a very chic restaurant, yet it's a very welcoming and fun restaurant. It's kind of fancy, but it's also super simple. And it sort of like straddles this line on all those times that you feel like you're somewhere nice, but you don't feel like you've got to behave yourself and don't put the fork in the wrong place, or am I using the right this or that?
Totally.
Feel, you walk in, you're like, oh, this is awesome.
And you know what? I think it was that time in Mexico City also, where the city was ready for good food in an informal environment, because usually good food was formal environment or street food. And yeah. Contramar is like in between. It was
because,
a good
yeah,
in between.
You said it's like the type of ceviche you can get on the beach in Zihuatanejo.
Uh-huh.
But it's a beautiful open space, a lot of energy. Do your waiters wear bow ties?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, they do. So whose decision was that? What did you debate? We just have casual waiters?
Yes, because it was in Mexico. You do not have. I mean, servers are. It's sort of a profession, and all these new restaurants in Condesa that had emerged in the late the 90s.
And explain Condesa. Explain Condesa.
Okay, Condesa is this neighborhood that sort of reemerged after the earthquake in 85, just because it was close to, it's close to downtown, cool apartments, and a lot of artists moved there because it was cheap.
Yeah, I would say it's not exactly, because Mexico is a very different city, but it's kind of has the feel of the West Village of New York, like tree-lined streets, little apartments, little cafes.
That now is very gentrified before it was rough.
But it's super nice to walk around in now as a
tourist. It's very close to downtown, and it's close to a bunch of neighborhoods, Roma, Condesa, Cuauhtémoc, Juárez. So it's this sort of newly discovered old parts of a city,
right? It's a great walking part of town.
A lot of green, a lot
little
of trees, parks.
Take your dog to the dog run, that sort of place.
Yes. And I, when we definitely wanted to do something there, but we were so clear on wanting professional waiters and tablecloths. And we were
that's also interesting. Yeah. Nowadays, no one has a tablecloth.
Nobody. Because it's also, you need to think of the ecological impact
of
that.
Well, that too. Yeah, washing them. Interesting.
But we wanted to make a statement of how we were focusing. Conceptually, I think it was perfect, but we weren't intellectualizing it that much. We just wanted a place where people could not spend a large amount of money, not think about it as a formal place to go on just special occasions. Sort of an everyday eatery, but with really good service and amazing food. And so for good food, it was 1998. In 1998, you needed tablecloths for people to think that the restaurant was halfway decent halfway sort of good.
But as a restaurant, it's funny because it doesn't have that feel of one of those old school, high end colonial style Spanish Mexico City restaurants. Nor is it super, like I said, molecular gastronomy and modern. Uh-huh. It's somewhere in that in between that just feels contemporary, and it feels as contemporary now as I imagine it must have then.
I think it, I think it feels more contemporary now than before, because before it felt just like I guess it did feel contemporary because people did really appreciate it very soon.
Yeah.
None of us had any experience. None of us had any, nobody knew us. Like nobody was going to go to the restaurant because we were famous or.
Yeah, it wasn't like people were waiting.
Nobody
for
had
the
any expectation. And so I think it was a good surprise. People were pleasantly surprised. Like these kids that were actually working instead of
brought energy to the place. All right, two restaurants. All right, before we get into the book and recipes, I want to hear your thoughts because two other sort of iconic restaurants that remind me of Contra Mar reminds me of One is Balthazar in New York City, uh-huh. and one is River Cafe in London.
And those were definite references for me.
Yeah,
for
and,
sure.
In what regards were they references?
Because River Cafe, because to me, my mom's from Florence, so it's food I really know in a very intimate way. And to have been in London and tasted those like flavors of basic, super simple, sort of contadino food in Italy was just, and in such a cool environment.
Yeah. Felt modern, but felt again, modern, very welcoming.
But again, and really good. Like the flavors were extraordinary.
Yeah.
And you eat a papa al pomodoro, which is something that you have in a trattoria in Italy or in your aunt's house. It's nothing fancy.
But served in nice tablecloths, but very professional but friendly waiters. It's also interesting with the River Cafe is that you're eating very, very authentic, sort of soulful, simple Italian food in London. And then what you were trying to do at Contramar is take this very coastal Mexican food from Zihuatanejo and transfer it to the middle of the country in Mexico City.
And for example, in Contramar, we did things like we were certain we wanted fresh-made tortillas. Nobody 20 years ago cared about fresh-made tortillas in Mexico City. Nobody was into corn or... Now we're all obsessed about it, and heirloom corn and heirloom varieties.
Yeah.
But 20 years ago, no fresh tortillas were found except for in certain very like Mexican, authentic, typical
restaurants. Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about some specifics of what you serve.
Okay, so River Cafe. And then Balthazar, just to finish with your references, that, it's sort of an institution in the city. And it was just this... Again, this I remember coming to Balthazar and thinking, wow, I mean, this is so well done.
Yeah.
And the food the food is great, but
I always say the food at Balthazar is good enough.
But also in 1997 it was better than now, maybe.
Yeah.
Or
sure.
Or you hadn't options.
I think what's unique about Balthazar, similar to Contramar, it's like you walk in and you just smile. You're just psyched to be there.
Yeah.
And still 20 some years later it's the same way.
Yeah.
All right, so I want to talk about just some food in your sort of approach to cooking in the sense of authenticity versus your own flavors versus your own upbringing and sort of your own interests. And like, as you have a recipe for guacamole, which is like the first thing that every American person wants to look at when they buy a Mexican cookbook, like, how do I make guacamole? And so you have some thoughts. It's interesting. You say, some purists insist that guacamole should be just mashed avocado and salt, but the truth is people across Mexico put all kinds of things in it. When I was young, my friend's mom served a guacamole that tasted different from anything I'd ever had. I watched while she mashed up the next batch and saw her spoon Knorr seasoning powder from a jar into the molcajete. Loaded with MSG, that bouillon was giving the guacamole an artificial injection of umami, which is why it was so tasty. However, you can get a complex and addictive flavor naturally from a blend of salt, lime, onion, tomato, chili, cilantro, and oil, which is how I make mine. Yeah, there's lots of different ways to make it.
They put grasshoppers in guacamole.
But you also add olive oil,
which
is probably not typical, right?
Right. I also add
and
olive
why?
Oil.
Because, why? Do you, why
because
olive
it
oil?
Ties it together and it comes out really smooth and nice. It just tastes good.
Do you think you would have done that if your mom had not, if you probably grew up not in an Italian household, I imagine you would not have reached for olive oil though.
I don't know. I guess olive oil, so many people have asked me that. So, I mean, because olive oil always was a thing in my house. But also, in Mexico, we have a huge Spanish heritage. So, olive oil is sort of a common enough ingredient in Mexico. And people do add it to guacamole. Like, I've seen other people do it. I think it's just not what you think about when you think of guacamole.
Yeah.
And it's also something that I've become very much, I think it's something that also here, or cooking in San Francisco, where you have amazing avocados, but not always as ripe.
Yep.
If you add a little bit of avocado, then it really becomes of olive oil to the avocados. They really like come together
and kind of smooths it out. Yeah. Interesting.
You know how sometimes avocados can be watery?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And ripe avocados are not, I mean, depends on the variety of avocados, but usually the best kinds of avocados to make guacamole with are very unctuous.
Like, buttery.
Buttery.
Yeah. So you've got this beautiful restaurant, you've got the ceviches, you have a couple other dishes we'll talk about that are very sort of iconic at this point. But you were very adamant about having homemade hand-pressed tortillas. And I guess the question is why? And also I think in America there's not really an equivalent in that we're a country of so many different types of cuisines. There's not that one thing that's always on a table when an American family sits down to eat necessarily.
You know not even I mean? Bread, right?
No, because it's also like maybe if you're Italian American, you've got this bread. But if you're a different sort of, you know, it's not
but you
like
know how in
these
days,
in this
you
day and
have
age.
Bread always.
Yeah,
at
but
a table,
yeah, but
and
yes,
different
but no
breads
one eats
depending.
Yeah,
on...
but in Italy, like there'll be Italian. There's always bread in the table in Tuscany. No one, everyone just looks at it, but no one actually eats it.
Oh yeah, yeah, you clean your plate with it.
No, they
depending
no,
on
they
where
don't.
You
they
are.
Never do. It's like bad saltless bread that no one eats.
Don't like, say that. Like, don't say that about Tuscan bread.
It's like water on the table. Also, the Italians that just look at the water bottle, but they never actually drink it. They're just too busy drinking wine.
No.
But yeah. So why you could obviously could have opened a nice restaurant without sort of insisting on hand pressed, freshly made tortillas every day.
But I guess one of the things that was really important at Contramar, and for me for sure, was flavor. And I think that's the Italian part of, you know. Not to idealize Italian ways of eating, but I do think that within this turmoil of industrialized food and the way that we've sort of come to eat everywhere in the world that is very, yeah, like lacking in flavor or adding flavor in artificial ways, I think Italians still have a very sort of a deep respect for flavors in different seasons in a way that of... sort of I just assimilated and that I wasn't as aware of, but for me food was always the important part of food was that it was good. Yeah. Like I needed, you know, for me food needed to be good in terms of quality, in terms of flavor, in terms of just good. And I know it's very relative to say that, but it really makes a difference when you're thinking of a tortilla that is freshly made is so much better than a tortilla that has been reheated. It's just, there's no, and as you say, maybe there's no comparison to any, like, carb, any bread. But, I mean, because some bread is not better freshly baked, right? You need it to sit and wait. But tortillas, for sure, are at its best when they're freshly made. And I grew up in Tepoztlán, so this is, again, the richness of having different backgrounds, like, while growing up, is that you are aware of different good things. And growing up in the countryside, I had access to amazing tortillas. They, you know, people there traditionally grow their own corn. They keep it for the rest of the year. They grow enough so that they can have it fresh and then they can dry it and then they can keep on making tortillas for the whole year till the next crop.
But do people still do that, or are they all just on their iPhones now and like they got
in
too many other things to do?
I promise
posting
you
on
they
Instagram.
Do. Unfortunately, in the country and as a whole, they are not. And it's,
but you see that in Italy too. Italy used to be such a sort of a quote unquote rustic company where people did things by hand. And as it gets modernized and as big grocery stores open, and it's like, oh, you know what? I'll just buy the pureed tomatoes. I don't need to puree them myself.
But you know what? They are really obsessed with quality in a way that is still like you. Italy, I think, and I don't want to generalize about this, but I do believe that even industrialized processes in Italy are smaller and ensure quality in a way, like even, like for example, when, you know, now that it's Easter season, everybody has colombas. I don't know how many people make them at home. I mean, I'm sure most of them are commercially distributed.
But
people do notice the difference in quality and the difference. And some of them are super expensive and you wonder why, but then you taste it and then it's like, oh, yeah, because this is actually made with eggs or this is actually
I think there's still an appreciation for ingredients and also you said for seasons in Italy especially. Like they really look forward to spring for like the first fava beans.
Yeah.
And artichokes and this and that. And they understand when things come into season. Although now with, you know, you have both parents working and stuff, like people don't have the time to necessarily do everything by hand. So you've got to sort of pick and choose.
Totally. But people go to the supermarket and have, you know, an offering of six brands and they do know that this one is better or this one is family run or whatever. I mean, I do think that the industrialization there hasn't been as bad, but it's been terrible everywhere. In Mexico, it's been really bad. People do not grow their corn anymore because it's not worth their while. They grow corn for themselves, those who can afford it. But in the countryside, people don't grow. I mean, people can't live off planting corn unless.
No. Yeah.
So it's, you know, we're
importing.
Yeah, the economics
of farming have completely changed.
But it's bad. I mean, it hasn't taken us anywhere better in the world. And especially in Mexico. In Mexico, and this is really sad, we have the second largest child obesity, population. And then tons of diabetes. Like really, like most sicknesses are related to diabetes. of adults in the country. And it's, you know, it's bad. It's reduced. I mean, it does make you think of how eating well is much more than just enjoying a meal.
Yeah.
And I've always been very aware of that. Like, I've always, for me, it's always been also like a political thing. It's always been very sort of a constitution of who you are to choose one thing over another and to pay the farmer instead of paying a corporation, or to, you know, to not do Nestle, but to actually go with the coffee growers and pay them whatever it costs them to pick the coffee, which is a pain, and you know, all, like with everything. And I think for restaurants, it's very, you know, now that's very popular. But 20 years ago, nobody was talking about that. In Mexico, people were talking about, you know, fancy chefs were talking about the perfect, as I was saying, like the perfect foie gras from wherever. And the sustainability or the, you know, the footprint, of, that wasn't even an issue.
But it's also when you open the restaurant, it's also, you're just trying to make it successful. When you're first,
we really did want to make a restaurant that was different, or a restaurant that was, we had no, you know, we didn't want to make a restaurant to compete in any type of way with fancy Mexican restaurants. We wanted it to be really good, tasty, with fresh Mexican ingredients that had not traveled or being, you know, or kept frozen, or and that people would be surprised by.
And you think that the customer could taste that difference without having to be told that
totally
difference. Yeah, they didn't need a PR release.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And then people started I remember thinking about it. Like, we always were very aware of the fact that word of mouth would be our best our best way to have the restaurant be full. And it was that way.
Over the years, have there been any like criticisms or critiques that you've actually been like, oh, that's a good point, maybe I should change this, or maybe I should
I mean, when you open a restaurant, and then
what,
you know,
mistakes did you make?
I think when you open a restaurant, you have to have clarity of what it is, because everybody's always wanting to tell you how, what it should be. Mm-hmm. And you know, everybody has their own idea of how they, you know, things should be, or how it should be served, or whatever. But I think, you know, through the years, we've just been more professional. We've become much more aware of, say, what have we done differently? I mean, in principle, we're doing the same, but we just have done it now to a much more sort of consistent degree.
Yeah.
You know, it's just we have these, you know, at the beginning, we were buying tuna that was, you know, who knew who had fished it? But now we know exactly where because also within the last 20 years, I mean, it always was an issue in terms of sustainability. And it was already, people who knew already were very sort of scared about it. But now it's really an issue. And the whole, you know, the way, the methods of fishing, and it's all.
Well, let's talk about that, because one of your trademark dishes at Contramar and a version of it at Cala in San Francisco are your tostada, your tuna tostadas.
Yes.
So talk to me about the sort of the creation of that dish, because that was not a typical dish at the time with like sashimi style tuna on a tostada.
No, it was not.
Like, that's kind of a fusion-y, or like totally, where did that idea come from?
I mean, it was the 90s.
Yeah. All right. So explain this dish to us.
Okay. So we really wanted to use Mexican fish. So our being local was using Mexican fish. And Mexican fish is, you know, Mexico is a big country with a lot of beaches. So Mexican fish is very relative. But the only point was we did not want to import fish from other parts of the world. And we, you know, black or dark meat in fish was never really appreciated. And I think that's a Japanese thing, that in Mexico, you know, with Japanese restaurants becoming more popular, and there were all these restaurants that were like doing fusion things in Mexico, or a couple of them then, because now they've grown like crazy. But there was this specific chain that was called Sushito. And they had this chipotle mayonnaise that was so delicious. And they would put it, you know, with the fake crab, with the, what's it called? The Japanese, anyways, they made this mix with this, like, you know, fish gelatin thing concoction with rice flour and chipotle and mayonnaise. And it was so good. And anyways, it was just all these things that were new flavors. But also with tuna was not appreciated in Mexico, because everybody wanted white fish.
Yeah, interesting.
So tuna was the cheapest fish, and we wanted to do something with the cheapest fish. And we made like a tuna fillet, and it was, I guess, here in New York or in other parts of the world, it was like a cool thing to have, like the, you know, blackened tuna.
Seared on the outside.
Yes, yes. But it wasn't, you know, it was, this is pre-Instagram. This is pre-social media at a scale as it is today. So it was a novelty in Mexico. It really was a novelty. And we wanted to use tuna because tuna was the cheapest fish. It literally cost 8 pesos a kilo, and now it costs, you know, more than 500. But we were also to blame for tuna being popular because it became an amazingly popular dish. And it was sort of, the inspiration was like the wonton.
Explain the dish to the reader who can't see this.
Okay, so this is a tostada. A tostada is basically a corn tortilla that is toasted or fried, but it becomes crispy.
And you were saying, which I did not know, that if you're going to make tostadas, it's good to have like day-old tortillas. You don't want super fresh ones.
No.
Because curl up when they fry.
Yes. If you want them to puff up, then you put them, you know, you put them in the oil when they're fresh. But if you want them to keep flat, you need to make them old.
Cool. Good tip.
Yeah, very good tip.
All right, so you get your crispy, freshly fried tostada.
Yes.
And then
we put a chipotle mayonnaise. Mm. And then marinated tuna that's been marinated in soy sauce, basically. Now we do it with tamari for the gluten-free.
Okay, so just, but raw tuna, thinly sliced,
raw
sashimi
tuna,
sashimi
style, really good quality tuna. You can't be, you know, you don't want the
nerves,
the fun, no. And then it has a slice of, or two or three slices of avocado, depending on how big it is, and fried leeks.
Little,
at the top.
Little wisps and of crispy fried leaves.
And that's it.
Is it like one person's job just to make these all dinner service or all lunch service?
No, you would be surprised. In Contramar, the cooks in Contramar are so efficient. It is amazing.
But
it's
how many
a,
of
such
these
a perfect
do you,
operation.
Like on a Saturday lunch that goes
how many
on from like 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. How many?
Like more than 2,000.
That's insane. Uh-huh. Wow. That's crazy.
And it's so four per plate.
And it's one of those things like if you go there, you get it.
Like everybody wants it. Everybody wants it. And then, going back to what you were asking, the sustainability of fishing and seafood and tuna and the whole issue with tuna. When I went to San Francisco to open this restaurant, I was convinced I did not want to use tuna because line caught tuna in San Francisco is not that local. Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's not, you know, not always. Sometimes you get it certain times of year. But what we could get year-round was this amazing trout. It was farmed in the border between Oregon and California, and it is so good. McFarland Farm trout, super fatty, delicious. And so we did the same.
And you said visually it's also very appealing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's orangey, beautiful.
Okay,
so salmon-y.
You got that Cala or Contramar, you got to get that. And then the other dish, speaking of Instagram,
that's partly your fault, you know?
No, it's not my fault.
Yes, it is.
Pescado a la talla?
Yes.
What does talla mean?
Talla means it's the way in the Pacific, it's tallar is to rub something. So it's like the rubbed fish, rubbed with the red chilies.
All right, so if you've not seen this fish on Instagram, just look, I'm sure it'll pop up in your feed. So it's a butterflied snapper that is painted red on one side with a sort of a spicy salsa and then green on the other side with a less spicy, but you were saying for your
not spicy,
for your Italian side of the family who doesn't like spicy stuff. But you get this very visually arresting green and red grilled fish, and it's like, oh my God, I want to eat that, but first let me get a photo of it. Hold on. And I'm sure you have got people every single day, people are standing up and trying to get an overhead shot of this fish.
Yes.
And everyone else to the table is annoyed.
Yeah, yes. But, that's what you would eat in the Pacific.
Yeah.
And it usually was grilled over fire on the beach or in a very simple environment. And it usually was red because it's the red part is a mix of different dry chiles.
Yeah.
And we did the other side just to make it accessible for people who didn't want to eat chile.
It ended up being one of those things like, oh my God, that looks amazing. It even looks better than the original.
Totally.
And then if you're not using like red snapper, what other fish would be good for this?
Anything related. It's not always snapper, but it's snapper family.
Something white,
in San Francisco, we use rock cod.
Okay.
And it's good. It works. It just needs to be firm enough that the meat holds up.
Do you, so you, before we move on, a couple more questions, you paint it before you flip it over and put the meat side down on the grill. Do you then paint it again after it comes off the grill just to give it a fresh coat?
No, you actually salt it first, paint it, or you know, add the sauce and then put it grill down. I mean, put the sauce down first.
Flesh side down.
And then to have it finish cooking, you put the
skin. Cool. Yep. I imagine you want clean grill grates for that.
Yep. Yes.
Before we get to your lightning round questions, Gabby, you are opening a new restaurant.
Yes.
Supposedly shortly with Jessica Kozlow of Squirrel fame in Los Angeles. This is going to be in Santa Monica. It's called Onda.
Yes.
Is it still on track? How's that going? Opening a restaurant is always a challenge, as you know.
It's always a challenge. So I know. We committed to this.
Where are we at with this one?
We are at the point where it's coming together. It's being built. It's inside the proper hotel in Santa Monica, which will open in June. And then they're going to give us a little bit of more time. They're going to open one section. And it's an old, really beautiful building in Santa Monica.
All right, so
they've done an addition. So they're going to open the new part, but then the old part, they're going to open later, and that's where the restaurant's going to be.
Okay, you had talked about how you sort of vibed with Jessica. She did a pop-up one time in Contra Mar, and as a person, you just got on the same wavelength with her. I could imagine that. You're a vibey person. Food-wise, if I had to guess what the menu, I don't know what I'm trying to like cross Jessica's sort of her very trademark food at Squirrel with your very trademark food at Contra Mar, and I don't, where do we end up? Like, can you give us an idea of what the menu is like?
Yes. You know, you have like a crispy rice with adobo, like chiles, dried chiles.
Yes. And then you have my wife makes that one. What's that one? It's like the crispy rice with the all the herb. Oh my God, so good.
So good.
Yeah.
So good. And then and we have different ceviches with not only lime juice, but like fermented
stuff that people in LA make.
No. We did one with fermented carrot juice and turmeric, and it was really good.
That sounds cool.
We cooked for the first time, sort of thinking of Onda, a couple of weeks ago at this woman in food thing for Resi.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun. It was fun. And the food was really good. And we really used it as an occasion to sort of come up with a menu that we could collaborate on. We had done things together, like very small, like additions, like Contramar additions to Squirrel, or this pop-up, or this breakfast brunch that Jessica cooked in Contramar, but we had never actually thought about it, and we're gonna start developing the menu.
Will she be doing some baked goods and such?
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
Yes.
And it'll be open breakfast, lunch, dinner theoretically.
Breakfast, lunch, dinner.
Do you have to do
hotel?
Are you doing room service?
No,
or no?
Thank goodness, no. Yeah, but we are gonna be doing the lobby, and we have to be open 365 days a year.
If you're staying at that hotel, that's probably one reason you want to stay there.
I know.
And if it's not open, you're like, what the heck?
I know. I'm sort of terrified and excited about it, but we'll see.
Okay, we're going to ask you some lightning round questions now.
Yes.
It's either or.
Okay.
You got to answer.
Yes.
And we'll just hit the ground running.
Yeah.
Mezcal or tequila?
Mezcal.
Do you have a favorite brand or?
Yeah, popular? I mean, there's so many.
There's so many.
There's so many.
How do you take yours?
Amaras is just the one we use more. Mm-hmm. How do I take mine? I like it straight.
Oh, straight. Not even chilled? Wow. All right.
Sometimes on ice, it can be, depending on the variety of mezcal.
I probably know this answer, but pool or ocean?
Ocean.
All right, on that note.
Only when I was a teenager, I was like, oh, the salt is good. No.
Pacific Coast or Gulf Coast?
Pacific Coast.
Fried fish taco or grilled fish taco?
It depends when.
Depends on, what do you mean depends when?
Yeah, it depends like where you are, what fish you have.
No, it doesn't. Fried fish. We all know that fried fish taco is the right answer here.
No.
Yes. How can it ever be better than a good, it's all puffing at the little mayonnaise and the cabbage and you're at the beach.
But grilled fish taco with like, I mean, come on. Pescado a la talla on a tortilla with refried black beans. Can't get better than that.
All right, we're going to agree to disagree on that one.
Okay, good.
Aisle or window?
Window.
Okay. Clogs or Birkenstocks?
For cooking, clogs.
Okay. Mexican Coke or American Coke?
Mexican Coke, 1,000%.
Do you sell that in San Francisco? Do you get it?
Nope.
No.
But we do have, we don't have Mexican Coke, but we do have a cane cola thing.
Okay. Agua fresca or horchata?
Horchata is a type of agua fresca.
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
There you go.
Okay. Just got schooled. All right, couple more. Roasted salsa or salsa fresca?
Like depends a pico for de gallo. What? It depends
oh,
for
like
what?
You don't get, no, you get one for the rest of your life.
Fresca.
Okay. Is there a secret to making good fresh salsa? Like what
fresh,
am I doing
good
wrong?
Good ingredients.
And that's it?
Yeah. If you do tomatoes, you know, the green tomatoes, which are not good, then it's going to be bitter and...
Tomato, onion, cilantro, lime juice, salt, anything else
that's
in there?
That's for pico de gallo.
Okay.
But you can make salsa fresca with different things. Like this is a salsa fresca. This green sauce is a salsa fresca because it's not...
What's going on in that one?
It's just... Salsa fresca just means everything
fresh.
Raw.
Yeah, not roasted.
Not roasted and, or cooked or dried. Or so that's fresh serrano, fresh green tomatoes. We put a little bit of avocado and we put some lettuce in that one.
Lettuce?
To give it crisp.
Interesting, yeah. Because it also has that beautiful green. And it also has that nice almost emulsified texture. Okay. Last question. Because we
I
always
like
ask this, but and I already know what your answer is, but we're going to do it anyways. Butter or olive oil?
Olive oil.
Obviously. Gabrielle Camara, thank you so much for joining us on the Bon Appetit Foodcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.